From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just days before a Harvard PhD student was going to get married. Jennifer Brea didn't understand why her body essentially began to fail. She experienced, at times, crippling fatigue, among other symptoms, and so she decided to document what she was going through. That film work became the seed for an ambitious project that would not only tell her own story, but connect to people around the world. Jennifer has ME, more commonly known as chronic fatigue syndrome. And even though her illness is twice as common as MS, for example, and affects millions worldwide, it still does not receive the same level of respect in the medical community. Some doctors still believe it's essentially psychological, that it's all in a patient's head, that a healthy person wouldn't suddenly lose the ability to stand or be bedridden for days. But it is real. Jennifer tells her own story with bravery in a film called Unrest. It's a personal documentary that is both heartbreaking and at times inspiring. It premiered at Sundance in January, and the film is coming to Rochester next month. Unrest is one of the films selected for the upcoming One Take Film Festival, and this hour we get a chance to explore some of the films and how the festival has come together. My guests include in studio Linda Maroney, who's a director and programmer for the One Take Film Festival and producer of The Last Dalai Lama, which we're going to be talking about a little later in the hour. Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Evan.
And Bree Merkel is artistic director for the Little Theater. Bree, always nice to have you.
Hi, Evan. Thank you.
And on the line with us is director Jennifer Brea, who is the subject of one of the subjects of the film Unrest. Jennifer, congratulations on the film, and I hope you know what I mean when I say I wish you didn't have to make it, but I'm really glad you did because of how much I learned. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer, kind of take us back to how the film really became a film. I know you were struggling to understand what was going on to you, but when did you know you wanted to tell the world about this and you were willing to put some very raw and personal moments out there?
Well, when I first started filming, I didn't have any particular intention for the film. For the video, I was capturing these moments on my iPhone when, you know, I wasn't at the doctor's office, when I was too sick to even make it there, and when no one could see me. And I did that in part because I found this experience really isolating and frankly terrifying. I came down with a high fever. And then within a few months' time, had become bedridden. And I had basically lost the ability to read or write. And so I started filming myself on my iPhone as the way of essentially keeping a diary and processing what was happening to me. And I think the moment that I decided to sort of try to take these kind of private videos and start to craft them into a film was twofold. Once I went to this doctor's office and he tried to explain in words sort of what I was experiencing, and he completely dismissed me. But when I took my phone out of my pocket and showed it to him, he sort of, the entire expression on his face changed. And I think there's a way in which visual evidence and direct experience are in some ways more powerful than words. And that's when I decided that this had to be a film.
There are moments where we learn about what the broader medical community, sometimes in other countries, doing frankly horrifying things. You know, we learn about what's going on there, but we also, you know, learn about the NIH. I mean, there are still people connected to major organizations in this country who say things like, well, why would you fund something, research for something that's not real or maybe not real? And I wonder, do you think it is possible that your film is going to hit policymakers and maybe someone who really kind of pulls those levers is going to see this and not to be able to deny it anymore?
I think that's definitely my hope because, in some ways I made this film because I needed to believe that the world was still a humane place, and learning how this community that I didn't even know existed before I got sick had been so neglected and so abandoned, I found it really shocking. And what I found so far as we started to kind of take the film out to festivals is that most people just don't know. And the reason why they don't know is because the sickest among us, those 25% that are homebound and bedridden, they never go to a doctor. Like, the medical system literally doesn't see them and doesn't know that they even exist. And so I think that it's a matter of trying to bring these stories out into the light. And I think that's the beginning of starting to create change. The NIH has started to make some strides, which are very encouraging, but it's sort of too small and too slow. And obviously, as you know, with the climate in Washington, our entire NIH budget is in peril. It's possible that 20% of the budget will be cut. And so it's definitely a tough time, but I think that it's really about trying to take the film out and reach not just sort of the highest level policymakers, but also, you know, medical doctors and foundations and people working in biotech, and to really try to mobilize our entire system of healthcare and research and innovation for this disease, because we've just been kind of left off the map for the last 30 or 40 years and have lost so much time. And at the same time, I think that means that if we started to invest with the technology we have now, we would find so much so quickly. And that gives me a lot of hope.
Before we play a clip from the film, Jennifer, what's the short definition for what ME or chronic fatigue syndrome is for our audience members who have either not heard of it or maybe only briefly heard of it and don't really understand it?
So it's a long-term chronic condition that is often gets triggered after some type of infection, either bacterial or viral. And the cardinal symptom is something called post-exertional malaise, which basically means after you exert yourself past whatever your limit is, and it could be walking for 30 minutes. If you're mildly affected, it could be brushing your teeth. If you're severely affected, then you crash. And crashing is not being able to move, not being able to lift your head, and being kind of engulfed in this really horrible cascade of inflammation and pain. So that's sort of the nature of the disease.
That's why I think chronic fatigue syndrome maybe doesn't fully do it justice as a common name, because it's not just that you don't have the strength to lift your head or you have to lay in bed. Unfortunately, in the film, we see you go through a lot of different pain and frankly, agony at times. How common is that for you now? How are you day-to-day now, Jennifer?
Day-to-day, I'm actually doing quite well. I have found treatments and access to drugs that... mainly antivirals that help my immune system to control what it's too weak to control. And I've also just learned my limits. So as long as I stay, you know, the way that I think about it is every day I wake up and I have a battery and it will only ever charge to maybe 40%. But as long as I stay within that, I can live pretty well. I still need to use a wheelchair when I leave the house, but I can live pretty well. But if I go past that limit, and it's so easy to miscalculate, then I'm back to where I was 5 years ago and what you see in the film, sometimes within a matter of a few hours, and then I'm crashed in bed.
I don't know what else to say other than I'm just so sorry to hear those things. I mean it's so difficult at times. And then, Jennifer, you kind of juxtapose some of those moments with comedians mocking chronic fatigue syndrome, with the medical community dismissing it. And I can't imagine what it is like to feel the emotion you felt in that clip we just heard, and then to hear people willing to joke about it. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is like?
Yeah, I know, it's funny. That clip is really hard to listen to. And it's from a moment in my life when I would wake up every day kind of disappointed that I was still alive, because it was just another day to endure. And that was in this moment when I was out of bed about 2 minutes a day, which was essentially just to make it to the bathroom. And that was something that I was barely able to do at that. And I think the thing that's really hard about this disease, I mean, there was a certain point where I reached when I was bedridden, where I kind of accepted that life is hard and it doesn't always work out the way that you expect it will, right? Like, people become ill, you lose people you love, you might get cancer, you might get MS or some other condition, and I feel really grateful for the life that I've had. But I think what's so hard about this disease is not just how physically grueling it is to live this way, but that kind of added layer of disbelief and of neglect. It's not just that you lose your life and you disappear from your community. It's that your community doesn't know that you've disappeared and why you're gone and what's happened to you. And that this entire sort of experience has been shrouded in stigma and stereotypes and this complete misconception. Because I know that if the comedians actually lived for a second in my body or even sat by my bed for 10 minutes. Like, they would never behave that way. And I think that's true also of our institutions and of society at large. And I think that, I think the sort of the most basic, you know, I do hope that this film starts a conversation, not just about this disease, but many other conditions that are difficult to diagnose or where patients are initially disbelieved, right? Because it happens not just to ME, which disproportionately affects women, but to many people who fall ill with an autoimmune disease and spend years searching for a diagnosis. I would hope that at a minimum, you know, I do hope for policy change. I do hope for funding, but I think the kind of most basic human need when you fall into a situation like this is just to be understood and to be supported and to be treated with compassion. And I think that's something that we can all do for each other in our own lives with the people around us. And I think that if this film accomplished just that, helping patients to feel more understood and more supported, I think that that would be a big first step, because I think if you have your community around you, it makes it just so much easier to survive and to find a way through.
Talking to Jennifer Brea about her film Unrest, which is going to be part of the upcoming One Take Film Festival at the Little Theater next month. We'll tell you coming up, it's May 18th through the 21st, but we'll tell you coming up the schedule there, because there's so much going on. And in our second half hour this hour, we're going to talk to you about the other films, the outstanding work, the documentaries that you can see, but also a lot of the fun that's going to go along with that, the music and food trucks and passes that you can get now. So there's a lot to discuss there. So we've got that coming up. But Jennifer's film, I've been focusing on her story. The film is also a story of how she was able to connect to people around the world. And when you talk, it's one thing to talk about a comedian who might make a joke, Jennifer, or, you know, people who don't really get it. It's another for me to see, particularly in other countries, there are things that are happening to people with this condition that I would have guessed it's the 1950s all over again. I mean, it's or earlier. I mean, it's really amazing. So can you kind of give me give our audience a sense for the stories that you were able to tell and the people you were able to connect with for this film?
Yeah, so the film was made in a fairly unusual way, which was that I was bedridden for most of production when we were sort of shooting the film. So I hired crews in different, sort of five different locations on two continents, to help me capture these stories and connect these interviews. And it was an amazing way of connecting when I was at my sickest with other patients and learning from their stories. And one of the stories that I found was of a young woman named Karina Hansen in Denmark, who was taken from her home by police because the doctors there perceived her condition to be psychosomatic. And I think part of the rationale was that essentially she has chronic fatigue syndrome, but she's stuck in a room with, sensitive to sound, in a dark room. It can't possibly be that serious, because that doesn't fit the conception of the disease. So she was taken and to a center for what's called functional disorders, which is essentially a modern sort of name for hysteria, and was kept from her family for 3 years. And this is actually not an uncommon story. There have been cases, dozens of cases across Europe and in the UK, in Germany, as recently as last year, in Norway. And actually, when I went and we had our European premiere in Copenhagen, I learned of, a family that has fled to Spain because they were afraid that their child would be taken. And it happens in the U.S. too. It's less common, but children are sometimes placed into foster care and suspected of being mistreated when they have diseases that doctors can't diagnose. And so the film does highlight that, but it's part of a much longer history. I mean, we used to institutionalize people who had epilepsy, people with multiple sclerosis, when we couldn't essentially measure their disease from the outside. And I think medicine has always had a hard time with what it could not objectively measure, because the patient's own account of, this is my life, this is how I was before, and this is what happened to me, is not considered evidence. And we've learned, I think, the hard way many times throughout history that frequently what we can't measure is a reflection not of the patient not telling an honest story, but of the limits of our technology. And so
I was just going to say at that point, I mean, it's this idea that, you know, if decades ago the answer was, well, that it's hysteria, you know, put it under this umbrella of hysteria. And there was probably something misogynistic too, because 80-85% of diagnosis of chronic fatigue are women. So, you know, hysteria. Or today it's, well, it's in your head because we can't figure it out yet. You know, it's just sort of just amazing to see that. Here's a listener question. Joel wants to know, what's the difference between chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia?
That's a really good question, and it's hard to say. I think that the way that sort of researchers and clinicians in the kind of ME-CFS, the ME chronic patient of the space, sort of describe it is that ME really has that hallmark post-exertional inflammation, and post-exertional collapse, and so patients with ME really can't exercise, even though that's the most commonly prescribed treatment, whereas many patients with fibromyalgia actually benefit from exercise. But I think that very often it's possible to have both conditions, and ME is often misdiagnosed as fibromyalgia. So there's definitely some confusion still there. But I think the most important thing is just to test your body, and also to see, you know, more than one expert. Because if I've learned one thing, you sort of every doctor has a completely different opinion. That is completely different, equally certain opinion about what's going on with you. So it's good to sort of seek out more than one perspective.
All right, Jennifer, before we let you go, I just want to talk a little bit about the actual filmmaking process, because you're the director and the subject of this film. And as you mentioned, there were days where you were essentially bedridden, and yet you found a way to create this absolutely amazing film. And I know you said you had a lot of help and some wonderful people working alongside you, but I just want to start by congratulating you on the film, and just asking you what you kind of learned as a documentarian about the craft. We're going to be talking to other documentarians and talking more about documentaries in our second half hour, but you know, how you now view the field having put this film together.
Well, I think I think I learned a lot. I think I learned one, and this is something that making a film on this scale with this is used taught me, and that's sort of the power of geological time. Documentaries often take a long time to make, but for me, the sort of I had this limited capacity, but it was a question of just taking whatever I had each day and every day making incremental progress. So that was a big part of sort of how I was able to make the film. But in terms of the craft, I mean, I think the thing for me that was very important to do was to try as much as possible to convey the inner experience of the disease, which I think people do a lot in creative nonfiction. You use sort of these techniques of writing novels to try to get into the internal experience and the internal sort of monologue of your characters, even though in nonfiction that's something that you can, you know, kind of guess at or hint at. And in this film, we really tried to do that. It was really important to me that we weren't just looking at patients as sort of these sick bodies that we're looking at observationally, but I wanted to try to bring you into their minds and memories and emotions, both for my own story as well as the stories of the other people that we captured. And so I think that that was a long process, but I learned through the process of making the film in some ways to trust the process. And it's only in sort of investing in trying to understand what your true intention is of your expression that you can achieve it. But it just takes a lot of time. And I mean, we edited the film for over a year, and it took a lot of experimentation, I think, to arrive at this place where you have that combination of the kind of the personal and the reflective and the political. But it was an amazing experience, and I think if I can say that I'm grateful to this disease for anything, it's that it's made me a filmmaker, and that's something I will have for the rest of my life.
Well, Jennifer, before we let you go, I got to ask Linda Maroney and Brie Merkel if they want to just weigh in on the film, because I know they're excited to be able to include it in the film festival. And, you know, Linda, I thought it was amazing. Yeah, your thoughts on it?
It's an incredibly powerful and beautiful film that makes the invisible visible in the most courageous way. I mean, I couldn't imagine being in Jennifer's position, feeling that way and taking out that camera, you know, taking out her phone and starting to shoot that way and then moving ahead. You know, obviously, she had to probably raise money to do this along the way, in addition to actually getting the production done and dealing with crews. And she did so much of this via Skype that it's incredible that it was done with that way and feeling the way she probably did through most of this movie. So it was incredibly brave to do that. And it captured us completely as soon as we watched it and wanted to include it in the festival.
Here's a comment on Twitter from Bob, who writes, "Kudos to Jennifer. And I have personal experience from a daughter's invisible chronic illness, which was grossly misunderstood by the medical community." That's from Bob. And Jennifer, I'll let you go with this. I imagine you're already, you know, hearing from so many people because, as we said earlier, millions of people around the world have chronic fatigue syndrome. So I imagine you are hearing from so many people, but, you know, can you share just a little bit of that connection that you're already starting to find through this filmmaking process?
I love the theme of the show because this has been the entire experience of making the film. I started out completely alone and in total isolation, and then I connected to the people in the movie, and then now bringing the movie out has brought me in community, you know, with thousands and thousands of people. I think what the feedback that I get is just this sense of being seen and of being heard and being held. And this is such a hard story to tell. I mean, people have been trying to tell the story for decades. And I think that, it wasn't always easy to kind of delve into these moments of pain in my own life. But what I've learned is that there's nothing that you can experience, no matter how private or awful, that other people haven't also experienced. And so in sharing it, it's sort of taking that pain and creating power from it. And people have just said, you know, again and again, like, thank you for showing the things that I don't want to show, that are too painful to show. So I think that's just the beginning of the community that we hope to create around this film.
The film is called Unrest, and you can see it as part of the upcoming One Take Film Festival, May 18th through the 21st at the Little Theater. Thank you, Jennifer. Congratulations on the film, and here's to continued good health and happiness for you, which I know you so deserve. Thank you for taking the time for the program today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm so thrilled to be at the festival.
Very good. Jennifer Brea, director and subject of Unrest. So before we take our short break here, let's make sure you know exactly when you can see Unrest. May 18th through the 21st at the Little is the festival. This particular film, they can see it when, Brie?
You can see it Friday, May 19th at 6 p.m. at Little Theater Number 1.
Friday, May 19th, 6 p.m., Little Theater Number 1. Anything else we should know about that night?
Jennifer will be doing a Skype Q&A after the show.
All right, very good. So there's your chance to do that. Let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back with Linda Maroney and Brie Merkel. We're going to talk about the other films in the festival, tell you much more about the festival that is coming your way, all coming up next after the only break of the hour in Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections. In our first hour, the many faces of poverty. School leaders in Brockport, both in the K-12 and at the college level, are partnering on a new conference called The Many Faces of Poverty. We'll talk about new research and what they hope to accomplish. In our second hour, Tiger Woods won the Masters 20 years ago. His dad said he would be bigger than Muhammad Ali and change the world, but he didn't. Is that his fault or ours? Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to tell you, by the way, that if you found value in the conversation about ME, about chronic fatigue syndrome, you might be interested in further conversations about health topics. And WXXI's national medical show, Second Opinion, is filming episodes here at our studios next month. And we'd love it if you want to be a member of the audience. So for more information or sign up for tickets for that, just check out WXXI.org /secondopinion tickets. WXXI.org/secondopinion tickets. Always learn some great stuff there and a great opportunity there. We're talking to Linda Maroney, who's a director and programmer for the One Take Film Festival, and Bree Merkel, who's the artistic director of the Little Theater. The One Take Film Festival is coming up May 18th through the 21st at the Little Theater. It's a celebration of documentary films. How many total films, by the way, guys, in the festival?
10 programs with 9 features, and then we have one regional short subject documentary show.
It is a several-day event that is about films, yes, but there are going to be, food trucks every day, music. So give me some of the extra fun stuff first. Give me some of the trappings of the fun, and then we're going to kind of work through some of the other films there. So what's coming up?
I think we really wanted to bring sort of the celebration of the festival experience to a film festival. So it's not just strictly films, but we have music before every screening, I believe.
We're going to have some kind of music before every screening. We have local musician Guy Higgins, who's going to be playing and bringing some friends in. So he'll be there every night, kind of like a house band sort of vibe for the whole festival.
There's going to be Q&As after the films. There'll be a food truck there every evening. We kick off at Good Luck, Restaurant Good Luck, for a happy hour on the Thursday evening from 5 to 6, which will be great. There'll be some filmmakers there. There'll be some pass holders. There's also a wonderful brunch on Sunday, our last take brunch at the Arbor Loft with some guests, including an Academy Award winning filmmaker called Steve James.
Steve James behind Hoop Dreams.
That's yes. The one.
Okay. I mean, he's done other things. It's unfair to always say, oh, he did Hoop Dreams.
Hoop Dreams is pretty big. It's pretty big. That's okay.
Yeah, so I'm just like planting a flag. That's how you know him. So a lot coming up here. And festival passes, $80 for non-members, $65 for little members. You can get them at otff.org, and then just go, or you'll find it easy, /passes and tickets. But bottom line is otff.org. $80 for festival passes for the whole thing there. So
mm-hmm. Yeah. We wanted to make it really, really reasonable so people could come out. And the website is live right now with all the films, so people can go and watch trailers and see everything there right now.
You should do that. I mean, you know, you just heard Jennifer Brea, but I encourage you, you know, it's one thing to hear her voice and to describe her experience, her life, the film that she put together. Watch the trailer, and you're going to want to be there when she is here, or her film is here, I should say, and she's going to be here via Skype. But if you can't do the whole pass thing, $11 general admission, $7 for senior students, little members, and members of the Rock Doc group. So a lot of different chances to see these films. And if we could, let's kind of work through what else is on the schedule. So,
yeah.
Lynn, can we talk about yours first? Is that all right with you? No, you don't want to do that?
It's up to you.
It's my show.
It's your show.
We're doing your film next, because there's a bunch of other ones. Tell us about The Last Dalai Lama and how it ended up, you know, in your radar as a filmmaker.
Sure. So The Last Dalai Lama is a film about His Holiness the Dalai Lama and about where he is now, well, where he was at 80. Now he's, I believe, 82 as of July, or turning 82 this July. Mm-hmm. And it was really a focus on what's going to happen. I worked with the director once before, Mickey Lemley, on a previous film called Ram Dass Fierce Grace that came out quite a few years ago. And it's someone I worked with really well. And Mickey is also the head of the board chair of the Tibet Fund in New York and has been involved in the Tibetan issues. He made a film about the Dalai Lama in the early 90s that played on POV and theatrical and did really well. So I was a director I had worked with before and someone that I knew could get us incredible access to the subject because
wow.
With independent documentaries, the two most difficult things are raising money and getting the amount of access that you really need to make a great film. So I knew fundraising is always a challenge, but I also did know that we'd have some pretty great access to His Holiness.
You've probably seen articles in the New York Times and elsewhere about this battle over the future of the Dalai Lama. You know, if he's going to be reincarnated, who gets to decide that? I mean, these sound like sort of fascinating.
It sounds like an SNL skit. I mean,
but it's a real thing.
It's a real thing. The Chinese have put a law on their books stating that they have to approve of any reincarnation on their soil. And obviously, I know you laugh.
I don't mean to laugh, you know.
Because it sounds like an SNL skit, but it's true. And, you know, there's a previous, there's a precedent. There was a Panchen Lama who was sort of the second highest Lama in Tibetan Buddhism. And he was taken with his family and they was replaced by someone else that was more, observant to the Chinese will and desire. So what's happening, basically, it's a chess match. And so His Holiness is saying, well, I may come back. Maybe I'll come back as a woman. Maybe I'll come back born outside of Tibet. But essentially, he has said that when he gets to a certain age, he'll take a poll of all the Tibetan people and let them decide if they want another incarnation. It's totally up to them. He says, "It's the teachings are there. I don't need to be here. There doesn't need to be a Dalai Lama. It's all there. All the knowledge is there." But he is pretty popular. So we think they are all going to vote to have another incarnation.
This is the 14th, is that correct?
Yeah.
He's the 14th.
Yeah.
And we've got a couple of clips. One of them with the Dalai Lama with students. You want to help tell us a little bit
right.
about this?
Right. So we shot that in Vancouver. Basically, he had been there quite a few years before and was on stage and doing a big conference. And educators came around and listened to what he said and about educating the heart along with educating the mind, that they need to go hand in hand and starting at a really early age. So they instituted in all of British Columbia to have heart-mind training in K through 12 schools. So he had come back, we went and filmed, and then he was meeting with two separate classes in Vancouver.
All right, let's listen to that.
How does gratitude help you? How can gratitude help us?
Gratitude helps us by teaching us that we have a lot that we should be grateful for and not just sitting around and moaning that we don't have what we want.
Gratitude helps us in many ways, like releasing a chemical in our brain called dopamine. It's a happy chemical.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right.
How about when we do the circle, how do you feel? How do you think other people feel?
It makes me feel calm.
Makes you feel calm.
Calm. Yes, now that's the point. I think that's very, very important.
So, Linda, I have to confess, you know, listening to this clip and listening to the way the students are reacting, I feel bad that I laughed a little at the idea that the Chinese government is setting laws on if you're going to be reincarnated on our soil, you know, we have to tax it first, whatever their law is.
Right.
You know, I'm laughing because it's so foreign to of an idea to me.
Yeah.
But then you hear the actual human being. And you realize that when he makes the point, maybe we don't need a Dalai Lama, the teachings are there. Mm-hmm. We can laugh at whatever we want to laugh at or be, you know, inappropriate the way I just was and feel badly about it. But there's a real humanity there. There's a real beauty, I think. You're talking about gratitude with kids.
Yeah.
Talking about that kind of value.
I mean, okay, so filming with him was tricky on certain levels. I mean, getting on his calendar, as you might imagine, takes several years in advance. But when you film with him, the tricky part is that he treats every single person exactly the same. So whether you're, you know, holding a microphone or you're the producer or anyone coming into the room. So when we had interviews with him set up, formal interviews, we had Mickey's head was right next to the lens of the camera so that it would look like His Holiness is looking right into the lens and speaking to you. But everyone else had to be not have eye contact and, you know, had to be scattered around the room and around the space because he would talk to any, you know, he would look anywhere, which is wonderful when you're in the room, but it wouldn't make sense later on when you're viewing the footage. Why is his eyes moving all over the place? So you always had to be very aware of things like that, which you wouldn't do with other, you know, subjects.
You want to be the kind of person who treats everybody the same.
Yeah.
I think we all do. We go through, because we all know people who, you know, they treat celebrities differently or the boss gets treated differently or whoever, the hierarchy at the office. And we want to be the kind of people who treats everyone the same. I would love to be known as that when I'm gone.
Right.
The Dalai Lama clearly, what you're saying is that's the standard for treating everyone the same. And it makes it hard to make a doc about them.
It's tricky. It's tricky. You know, you want to have that intimacy for the audience. And so, you know, I was hiding behind Mickey and there was, you know, the camera person head down. And it was, you know, you just have to be very aware of not being in a space that you could make eye contact with him.
Are you also at that point just working, Linda, or are you taking a moment to say, it's the Dalai Lama. Like, I want to absorb a little bit of this too.
Yeah, you know, we had two shoots in India with him. I only went to one, but we shot with him in Vancouver and New York and all over, you know, all over the place with him. So there's definite times where you it's a different level of peace, honestly, when you're in his presence that is very tangible.
Well, let's listen to another clip here. And this is the Dalai Lama on his reincarnation, you know, the idea of his reincarnation. So let's listen to that.
I have no wish to born some heavenly sort of place. But I wish, my only sort of desire is to reborn where difficulties or problems, where I can make some contribution.
That's another beautiful idea.
Yeah, he's, you know, there's none of that ego. There's none of that eliteness about him. It's like, well, where can I do the most good? And it's just surrounds him constantly.
So he's going to be 82. And you make this film at a time where, as you say, there's a real political debate.
Yeah.
In China, there's a lot of discussion about what happens next, who gets to decide. But what did you really want the audience to walk out of this film with, Linda?
You know, it depends. I'm sure Mickey has other ideas too. Mickey will be coming to the festival, so he'll be there for Q&A. And I can't even tell you how funny and wonderful he is at Q&A. But for me, I think the Tibetan issue for a while was very sexy in our culture, that we were very aware, the Beastie Boys were throwing concerts, you know, we wanted to do stuff. And then it just fell off our radar.
Yeah, I do agree with that.
And meanwhile, I don't know what it's up to. It might be 146, 47 people that self-immolated in Tibetan, you know, Chinese-occupied Tibet. So they feel that their only resource to have a voice in this world is by setting themselves on fire, right? And we're not hearing that story. And how do we make a difference? So for me, being part of this film and getting that information out and bringing that back to the table for discussion is incredibly important.
Yeah, as woke as this next generation wants to be, I don't think, and I'm not saying this, you know, sort of derisively, these things do come and go in culture and some things recede in our view, but do you think millennials know what free Tibet means? You know, I mean, that conversation doesn't...
I don't know.
Doesn't happen.
I don't know, but hopefully things will change again.
Well, when can we see the film?
When can we see?
Yeah, now we turn to Brie Merkel for that.
It's going to be on Saturday, May 20th at 6:30 p.m. with Mickey there after the show for a Q&A.
All right, so that's The Last Dalai Lama is Saturday, May 20th, 6:30 p.m. at the Little Theater. There's your chance to see that. The festival is Thursday through Sunday, the 18th through the 21st of May.
Yep.
Good idea now just to get your festival passes lined up, and then you can kind of take a look at the whole schedule. We've had a chance to focus on a couple of the films, but there are more to talk about. And at this point, I just want to turn to Linda and Brie to kind of walk us through what else is on the calendar. And I was going to say, what stands out to you? We should talk about all of them because there's, I think, what, 7 or 8 more that we can discuss. And I would also love to hear from you, you know, how they ended up coming to this festival. So why don't you work me through the schedule?
All right, I'll start. So Thursday, we're opening the festival with Quest. Quest is an amazing, beautiful documentary. It's about a family in Philadelphia. It follows them for about 6 years, I think.
I think it's maybe even closer to 10.
Okay, all right. So a long time. And it's just incredible access. The father produces hip-hop records and albums in his basement. The mother is a nurse. They're struggling to make ends meet. They live in a rough part of Philadelphia, and you just end up feeling like you're a part of the family. You leave the movie loving the subjects. It's so, you also feel how much the director cared for these subjects during the film. They go through a lot of adversity and they just keep getting stronger. So it's just one of those movies that, even though hard things are happening, you leave just feeling like you've seen kind of the power of the human spirit. So it really touched me, and we're going to be talking with the producer of the film. We'll be here after the show.
By the way, that's Thursday, May 18th. First film up starts at 6:30 at the Little Theater, and it follows the Good Luck Happy Hour that starts at 5.
Right,
so if you're planning your night, 5 o'clock for the Good Luck Happy Hour. Then you get over to Quest, which starts at 6:30. 9:30 that night is a film called I Called Him Morgan. Tell us about that.
Okay, that is about jazz musician Lee Morgan. And I will admit that I do not know a lot about jazz music. I know. I picked movies. That's what I focus on. But I had to pick one. But Lee Morgan, he played with Dizzy Gillespie and had his own band that was really popular and ended up kind of falling into troubles.
On Blue Train, the amazing, amazing record Blue Train, too. And he was like a teenager at that point.
Yeah, like 18, I think, or something. Yeah. But it's also kind of this sort of whodunit murder mystery because he was murdered later in his life, kind of right when he was primed for a comeback. So even if you're maybe not sold on the jazz music part or that's not your thing, it ends up really drawing you into this story of like, how did it come to that and what happened and why right when he was kind of about to turn his life around a little bit. So it's fascinating and it's got obviously some great music and I loved it without knowing much about jazz.
And what I'm reading about this is one of those docs that was helped by the fact that years later you get this amazing interview and all of a sudden you've got this backbone for a film. So, all right. So that's called I Called Him Morgan, followed by a 30-minute Q&A.
Yes.
And that's 9:30.
Hopefully. We're working on it.
Oh, okay.
That's in the works, sure.
That's at 9:30 on Thursday, May 18th. Okay. Friday, May 19th for the One Take Film Festival. Starting at noon, you've got short films and a long lunch. Tell us about some of the short films.
So we have 8 short films playing by local filmmakers. Some of them are RIT students. Some of them are professional filmmakers in our community, have been making films for a long time. And we really want to support local documentarians. And so this was our way to do it. Do you want to talk about the lunch part?
Yeah, we're going to have boxed lunches or maybe bagged lunches. I'm not sure what she's going to pick from Orange Glory. And people can grab lunch really fast, go into the theater. We encourage you to eat while you're watching the movie. Tell the boss that you're going to be a little bit late back if you're working that day. It should hopefully be gorgeous out. We're talking about the end of May, so we want people to come and celebrate our regional filmmakers with that shorts program, and there'll be a Q&A with hopefully all of them right after the show.
All right, and then 6 p.m. on Friday, May 19th, as we mentioned, Unrest with Jennifer Brea. She'll be doing a 30-minute Q&A following the film via Skype. Anything you want to add before? Because then, following that film at 9 p.m. on Friday, May 19th, is a film called Whose Streets?
Yes, and that is one of my favorites, definitely. It's a film that follows the riots in Ferguson and was filmed by two very active Black Lives Matter activists who live the life of activism and who had pretty incredible access to the actual things that were going on in the streets during you know what were called riots and during the conflicts in Ferguson. And I saw a lot of things that I hadn't seen before in any normal media coverage of that. So we're hoping that Sabah, one of the directors of the film, will be there with us for a Q&A. We're locking that up right now.
Okay. Saturday, May 20th at noon, Dolores. Tell us about Dolores.
So that's a wonderful film about Dolores Huerta. She worked with Cesar Chavez for immigrants' rights and farm workers' rights, and she sort of was behind the scenes. People don't know her name like they'd know Cesar Chavez, but she was a powerhouse, and she's absolutely, I mean, the one word that comes to mind is fierce. You wouldn't want to mess with her. But she also, it also touches on the rise of feminism in addition to activism. You know, Gloria Steinem's in the film, all these wonderful people. But it also talks really openly to her children. You know, it, there's interviews with her children about what it was like growing up with this powerhouse of a mom who was away weeks and months at a time and what that was like. And she had more than one marriage. She had lots of kids. And, you know, often that's okay for men to do, but we don't like our women to act that way. So it just is very open about this in a way that we haven't put it in context before. It's quite wonderful.
3:30 in the afternoon on Saturday, May 20th at the Little, The Islands and the Whales.
I love this movie so much. It's wonderful. It's about a tiny group of islands called the Faroes that are between Iceland and Scotland, I believe. And they're incredibly isolated from the rest of the world. And it's beautiful cinematography. It's stunning. And it kind of becomes so many different films in it. You know, it starts out feeling like one of those great kind of travelogue documentaries, seeing a part of the world that you've never seen or might probably won't ever see. And then it turns into this sort of, you know, eco warning, just, you know, showing that industrialized and commercial fishing have led to problems there. Mercury in the water has led to children getting sick on this island because they still hunt and eat whales on this island as a regular part of their diet, as they've done for hundreds of years. So it's showing doctors trying to convince people who have had this as part of their heritage to stop eating whale, and the backlash against that. Pamela Anderson shows up on a you know, anti-whaling boat and tries to tell these people that they shouldn't be eating whales, and tries to stop people from their sort of seasonal hunt, and they end up getting arrested by the police, the people trying to stop the townspeople from killing and eating the whales. And I keep saying to people, I never thought I'd be on the side of the people who are killing the whales. But this is the way that if fishing was done this way, mm-hmm. it would be sustainable and it would be okay. You know, so there are just so many things going on, and you just see this little part of the world that's so intensely interesting. So I hope people will come out for that.
All right, I'm starting to panic because we're down to three minutes. So 6:30 that night is the last Dalai Lama, as we've said. Yep. So there you go. 9:30 is Brimstone and Glory.
This is wonderful. This is a Mexican film about this town that over half their population creates fireworks. And it is this incredibly twofold. It's absolutely stunning. The music is amazing. The cinematography is phenomenal. But it's also incredibly dangerous and horrific. People have lost lives, have lost limbs. But yet it's twofold. It's an hour and 5 minutes. Do not miss that movie.
Awesome. And then Sunday, May 21st, you start at 10 o'clock with The Last Take Brunch for pass holders. And then starting at noon, you got Steve James. You got Abacus first, followed by Hoop Dreams. So what's Abacus, by the way?
Abacus is this another wonderful movie, and it's very different than other Steve James's work, but it's about this small Chinese family bank in Lower Manhattan that was actually prosecuted in 2008 when all the other banks weren't. And prior to that screening, we are going to present Steve James with our Double Take Vanguard Award. After Abacus, there'll be a Q&A with our own beloved Jack Gardner.
Awesome. And then 3:15 is Hoop Dreams.
Hoop Dreams. What a way to go out, right?
Why is he, you know, for someone like you, Linda, who I consider not only a great documentarian, but someone with a really great taste in documentaries, and what you do for our community, not just this festival, but on a regular basis at the Little, I think makes this community better. I think it makes our art scene better. It's the kind of thing that people who live in New York City probably hope to have. We should be very, very proud of this. What makes James such a great documentarian?
He's incredible. He's a master documentarian. Like we were talking before about access and how difficult that can be. It can be even more challenging than fundraising. And Steve has this personality that endears him to people of all different walks of lives, and they become open with him and give him their stories and know he'll treat it with respect and integrity and show the complexities of it. It's not like he's going to gloss over and make it all look pretty, but he'll be completely honest with it and not everyone does that, but he does it in an incredible, powerful way that we're lucky. We're incredibly lucky to have him for a first-year festival, even though the series has been going on for 5 years now.
Well, and you know, you think about that. You think about what people like Linda have to experience. You're getting ready to make this film. You know the story. You get there. But when people get on camera, sometimes they change.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you want them to be them. I mean, it's the same thing when you sometimes they come in the studio for an interview, and I'm going, we had talked before this. Right. Why, you know, come on. And you're saying he's just amazing at getting that real essence.
He breaks it down in a way that captured it. And all of his work is like that. So it's something to aspire to. So the idea of showing two different pieces of work, we get to have that discussion.
Abacus, Hoop Dreams, Steve James, great way to close the festival. Online where to get a lot more information? Trailers to check out, get passes, get tickets, online where, Brie?
OTFF.org.
Well, congratulations to you both. It's going to be great. It starts May 18th. May 18th through the 21st at the Little. Plenty of time for you to plan, make plans for that now. It's going to be a great launch there. A lot of fun. So Brie Merkel, Artistic Director for the Little Theater. Thank you, Brie.
Thank you.
Always nice. Linda Maroney, congratulations on the film and the festival, and we'll see you there. Thanks
so much, Evan.
Our thanks to John Andrus, Behind the Glass, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon and weekend, and we're right back with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.